Throat is coming up, and I want to take a different tact, a different approach this year, and this may turn into 2 different weeks, which is fine, because Yom HaTzmaut's on Tuesday, and we're meeting on Wednesday. But before actually going into the sources, a bit of an introduction is necessary. When you talk about Zionism, talking about a political movement that has a particular ideology and a lot of different strains. Strains that are cultural, strains that are historical, strains that are more political, but they all converge in the idea of the right of the Jewish people to reestablish themselves as sovereign somewhere, and most of those strains would agree that that somewhere is in Israel. When you talk about religious Zionism, you're going into a whole different area, and it's a little bit of a misleading statement, because it sounds like it's Zionism with some sort of religious orientation to it. That's not at all the case, because any version of religious Zionism that exists is something wholly different and wholly different than what Zionism is, although it incorporates some features, in some cases a few features only, of what classical Zionism is, or what secular Zionism might be called. And so, just for broad strokes, I want to present 3 different approaches within the world of religious Zionism that have existed and continue to exist, although from time to time one becomes more prominent and others fade into the background. And that has a lot to do with what's going on in the world and the fortunes of the Jewish people, etc. So, to be honest, the first version, if you could call it, of religious Zionism is something that we'll call radical messianism. When I say radical messianism, I don't mean radical in the political sense, but radical in the historic sense. Meaning that the notion that what is happening and what we're developing and what we're seeing happening in front of our eyes is part of a supernatural messianic process, which at some point in that sequence of events will culminate with a metaphysical change in the world, which will leave Am Yisrael sovereign in Eretz Yisrael, and all of the messianic promises, whatever they may be, and that's what we're going to focus on, fulfilled. And that really was the vision that was hinted to in by the Ari and his students in what they felt was the push towards at least 2 different movements that they were part of. One was an aliyah, because they came from different parts of the exile. Some of them came as a result of the Spanish Inquisition, but the Ari, of course, came from Egypt, where nothing like that was happening. And part of it was the switch in public policy about teaching Kabbalah. Up until the Ari's time, Kabbalah was exactly what the word means, which is a private transmission from teacher to student, only when the student was seasoned and was mature enough to handle it. And it was the Ari who promoted the idea of publicizing Kabbalah, but he saw it within the larger scope of redemption. And redemption meaning in a messianic sense, that there's going to be what we refer to as an itaruta dilatata, an urging from below that's going to be responded to by an itaruta de la'ela, an urging from above, an awakening from above, and that God's going to redeem us, and it'll all be sort of in that sense, we would even call it otherworldly. Now that follows a particular strain, but by no means the only strain or even the mainstream strain of thinking in rabbinic and midrashic literature about Mashiach and about what that's going to be like. But there certainly is a strain that talks about supernatural events and a different kind of world coming out. There are those who will claim, and they have a lot to anchor this claim on, that the Vilna Gaon, on one hand, and some of the early proponents of Hasidut, on the other hand, because you can't put them on the same hand, but that they sent their students to Eretz Yisrael at the beginning of the 18th, of the beginning of the 19th century, was also part of the same idea, to be there and go to prepare spiritually the playing field for a messianic arrival. And as a result of that, when you look at the Ari 200, 300 years earlier, they were engaged in mysticism and they were engaged in devotional Judaism. And when you look at the students of the Vilna Gaon and the Hasidim, who came at the same time, the year of the 19th century, they went to what commonly became known as the four holy cities of Judaism. I don't know who made up the term, but the four holy cities of Judaism, which were Tzfat, Tveria, Yerushalayim, and Hebron, and established Kol Olim and little communities that were not really subsisting very well and that were being totally supported by Chutz La'aretz communities. And the idea was to sort of pave the way spiritually. So that was something that we might call radical messianism. And that was really the earliest form of it. What happens at the end of the 19th century, when political Zionism is a reality and things are starting to move on the ground, and people are starting to come and actually settle the land and create the beginnings of an infrastructure of industry, which then leads to the beginnings of the beginning, like faint embryonic beginnings of an infrastructure of a government, meaning with defense mechanisms and some education and housing, etc., and all those things that ultimately lead to a state. The more prominent approach within the world of religious Zionism shifted. And as I said, the strains go up and down with time to what we might call modified or gradual messianism. Right? Exactly. And the notion that Rav Kook, but Rav Kook was not the only one, other great thinkers were describing what they saw as being a process of Geula, but I'll call it Geula with a capital Gimel, meaning the Geula that we have all anticipated, but it's not going to happen with a flash and bang. It's going to happen with a slow process. It's going to happen, and this is a big part of Rav Kook's Chidush, it's going to happen through people who are vehicles of that Geula without necessarily intending it. In other words, secular Zionists are part of that process. And it's going, and it's settling the land and building the land also are all part of the process. And Rav Kook was perhaps the most prominent spokesman, but by no means the only one. But the one thing that he had in common with the earlier strain is that they all saw the process of Zionism as being a messianic process. And that the end goal and the end point of that whole process would be a messianic reality. Now, what's a messianic reality? Good question. But something that we would loosely refer to as the end of history. Then, there's a whole other strain that really developed only in the beginning of the 20th century. And it's the strain that, and the Mizrahi Party has had these three strains pushing and pulling at it both throughout its history, whether the Mizrahi Party changed its name, but you know the party of religious Zionism and the movement of religious Zionism and B'nai Akiva have all had, and etc., have all had these three strains pulling in different directions. Gush Emunim is part of this issue. And that is what we might call practical religious Zionism, which is to say, and it's not, and again, it's still very different than secular Zionism. It's saying, look, there's no question that Jews being in Israel is better than Jews being in Chutz La'aretz. And there's no question that Jews being sovereign is better than Jews being oppressed. And there's no question that Jews being together is better than Jews being dispersed. All of those, we'll all agree. And there's no question that from a religious perspective, all those things are benefits. And if we look at the events happening in front of us, we see that God is allowing and promoting these things to happen. And we would refer to that as a form of salvation. Or shall we call it Geula with a small gimel, right? A redemption. And so what happened is during the pre-state years, there was this ferment within that world about what are we looking at and how do we look at it? And it's what led to the very radical anti-Zionism in the religious camp about how we're interpreting events. Because the more that you interpret it messianically, and the more radically you interpret it, the more you're allowing for the polar opposite to be taken. of the deposition. What happened for the most part, although constantly all three, and there's schools of all three, and there are spokesmen for all three positions, what happened typically between 1948 and 1967 was that the practical religious Zionism school was the predominant one within the Mizrahi world, and the Mizrahi party, both politically and institutionally and educationally, was promoting that sort of approach. Did not necessarily see in the events that were happening something huge and fireworks that were going to take place, but rather a slow process. What was going to happen at the end of the slow process, unclear, and not necessarily that significant, meaning it doesn't matter, but we got to do what we got to do. 67 changed all that. June 67, it's appropriate we're doing it this year, it's 50th anniversary, suddenly shook everybody and created messianic expectations. You know very well that there were people who on June 7th or June 8th, 1967, immediately issued a clarion call to bulldoze whatever buildings were up there and start building. Right? You know that existed. You know that there were people who certainly were promoting immediately the idea of going in en masse to Hebron, to Shechem, etc. The government played it very, very differently, whether for better or for worse, wisely, not wisely, that's what happened. But there was certainly that streak. But there was a very strong messianic feeling going on in Israel, and some people around the table remember that, after 67 for a number of years. And so that strain became more prominent. What shifted things? 73. Right? And that's what I'm pointing out, is that the events that take place will promote or push down certain schools. And for instance, we saw this happen again, just to bring this to one more point much closer, we saw this exact tension take place within the world of religious Zionism, which has, Baruch Hashem, grown, both in numbers, in institutions, but most importantly, in thinkers. There are more people who are serious thinkers writing within this world than we've had. This same crisis of belief happened twice in the last 40 years, I'm saying after Yom Kippurim, once was in 1982 with the Pullout from Yamit, and much more critically in 2005 with the Pullout from Katif. There were people in strong bastions of religious Zionism in Israel that stopped saying the prayer for the State of Israel as a result of 2005. I don't know if they continued to not say it, or it was just temporary, but that was the sort of stuff that was going on. And remember, the phrase Reshit Tzmichat Gulatenu, which is a very pregnant phrase in that tefillah, was part of the flashpoint. Because you say, well, we're giving back land, that must mean we're moving back. That means, because you're viewing the entire process as a linear process going in one direction, if you're moving back, then that means you're either impeding what God's plan is, which makes you a terrible Rasha, or it means that God's plan is not to go linear, and we didn't understand it, and we got to rethink the whole thing. So these things have created crisis of, not of faith, but crisis of understanding and of interpretation, therefore identification with a particular stream of thought. It's a little easier to be part of the quote-unquote practical religious Zionist school, because then very little shakes you, because you're not dependent on outcomes to justify your position. On the other hand, you may be missing the boat. All right? It's the old John Wooden problem. So I'll just explain by one chap about the Wizard from Westwood. John Wooden, we all know John Wooden, the great coach of the UCLA Bruins for many years. One of the things I remember as a kid growing up and watching those 30-0 teams, the teams that won championships every year, was watching them beat USC even, and other rivals, and walking off the court like they just finished a business meeting. And I was a little chagrined. As a kid, I was jumping up and down at home watching, and you know, these guys just walking off the court. And the only time they ever got excited was when they won the national championship every year, and they climbed up and cut down the net, then they were kind of smiling. But otherwise, like business as usual. And I want to know why. So I read some of Taras Wooden, and it turned out that Wooden taught his players to be very even keel and take everything in stride. And I only got it when I saw that very famous loss when I don't know if you remember, when Yisrael lost to Houston 71-69, finding that Alcindor had his eyes scratched, and they walked off the court with their heads held high. It was like a great chat. The fact that you can walk off after a loss with your head held high is because you take everything with equanimity. And the price of that is you don't jump up and down when you win. All right, that's the cost, cost price benefit. So practical Zionism kind of has that wooden-esque flavor to it, that whatever happens, that's part of what we're working on, but it doesn't make us have to reorient what we think about our own position. The more excited you are and the more you see this as being part of some grand movement, the more that everything that doesn't fit has to now be reevaluated. So that's the plus and the minus. I'm not coming down on side of anything here. I'm just trying to present a little bit of the history, because what I'd like to do today, and perhaps we'll continue next week, is take a look at some of the Mekorot that we have, the earliest Mekorot that we have on Mashiach. I say the earliest Mekorot that we have because Mashiach is really something that is almost unmentioned in Tanakh. There are allusions to it. There are outright statements in Yechezkel, the David, Avdi Melech Alehem, Melech Olam. Question is, what does that mean? Hinei Malkech Yavo, in Zechariah, here and there, but very little. And the overwhelming majority of sources that speak about a redemption, small r, or redemption, capital R, meaning a redemption like coming back from Babel, or redemption of escaping Spain, or capital R, the one that we all anticipate, the overwhelming majority of sources speak about God doing that, not a person. And so the primary place to look for see classical Jewish sources about Mashiach is the Gemara and Midrashim. So there's a few Gemarot here that I collected that I want to look at, and you'll notice they're all, the Bavli are all in the same place. So one quick intro to that place, because it's informative and it's kind of interesting to know, is Mishnah, as you know, is geared towards law. Mishnah is law. And as such, Mishnah is all about the three components of any legal system, which is what you're obligated to do, what you're forbidden from doing, and the legal consequences of your actions. You're not allowed to go through a red light. You must go through a green light. And if you go through a red light and get caught, you'll get a ticket. Very simple. Right? You're chayiv to eat matzah on Pesach. You're not allowed to eat chametz on Pesach. And if you find chametz in your property on Pesach, then you have to destroy it in the middle of Pesach. Right? The Mishnah rarely deviates from that. However, there is a Mishnah in Masachet Sanhedrin, which is therefore a reason, because the second half of Masachet Sanhedrin deals with all those people who are deserving of the death penalty. What kind of crimes get the death penalty, each death penalty, and how is it carried out? And so as an introduction to a piece of that at the end, which is sort of another aspect of the death penalty, we have a famous Mishnah. Now, it's very famous because of the opening line. Nobody knows the rest of it. Not really nobody. Kol Yisrael yesh lam chelek l'am avah she'nemar v'meich kolam tzadikim, etc. We all know it because we all say it when we start Perek. Right, Perek Avot, we all introduce with that line. But we cut off at that point because the rest of the Mishnah is ve'elu she'en lam chelek l'am avah. Here's the list of people who don't have a chelek l'am avah. And part of what's on that list is not issues of behavior, but issues of belief. Meaning, if somebody maintains X or Y, then they don't have a chelek olam haba, which opens the door to long, long discussions about Jewish belief, and about heresy, and about the Epicureans, Epicurus. All that stuff is, for the most part, found in Sanhedrin. And since the law, one of the line in the Mishnah is, Kol ha'omer she'ein tchiyat ha'mitim min ha'Torah. So anyone who claims that resurrection is not a principle found in the Torah, meaning, even if you say, yeah, I believe in resurrection, but it's not found in the Torah, then ein lo chelek olam haba. So the Gemara immediately starts saying, okay, very nice, where is it in the Torah? And suggests all sorts of things and knocks every one of them down because, you know, you can't find it there. And then goes on to long discussions about tchiyat ha'mitim, Mashiach, etc. So that's where most of these sources are found. There's one source from the Yerushalmi that is a very popular source these days, but everything else is from that section of Sanhedrin, and some very, very popular sources of Mir. And I'll just tell you one little vitz, one little story about how popular they are. They're so popular they get mangled. You know, the more popular things are, the more they get mangled because people quote them without looking at the text, and they little variations. So years ago, I was giving a mini course on this to my seniors. These people are already senior citizens now, but we were talking about the issue of Mashiach. When's Mashiach supposed to come? And one of the students said, "Oh, he's supposed to come by the year 6000." I said, "Really?" He said, "Yes, Rabbi X, who at the time was teaching at the school, he's now X, but Rabbi X said that if Mashiach doesn't come by the year 6000, he'll be the first one to eat a cheeseburger." So I knew he had to be misquoted, because that's crazy. And by the way, this happens not in, it happens in every high school. Teachers get misquoted, always to the extravagant, you know, and to the crazy. And then get quoted to other teachers. And the hope, of course, of the student is that they can start a brawl. And the main goal of that, of course, is that it won't be class. But, Nachon?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Now, so I said, you know what, I'll talk to him. Because I don't believe he said that. So I went up to him and I said privately, I said, "I just want to let you know, this is what the students quoted you as saying. I'm sure you didn't really say it, but you know, I just want to let you know. You must have said it in a way that allowed them to somehow put that twist on it." He said, "You're right, I didn't say that. What I said was that if Mashiach doesn't come by the year 6000, I'll be the first one to convert." I said, "I'll take the cheeseburger," right? So, I mean, the first question obviously is convert to what? I mean, that's kind of a big problem, and what does conversion mean? But he said, "I was just trying to show them how strong my emunas chachamim is, right? How strong my belief in the words of Chazal." So I figured, well, you know, let's actually take a look at the Makorot. I couldn't do that with him, because he had already decided what Chazal had to say, so showing him wouldn't help, right? So I thought that might be something that would be interesting for us to look at. And so let's start at the top and see what we got. Okay, the first issue is, what is the world supposed to look like when Mashiach comes? And I mentioned to you that there were already two strains of supernatural messianism and historic messianism. In other words, the world's going to become a whole different place, or Am Yisrael is going to be sovereign in their home, but nothing fundamental is going to change about the world. That's a machloket that goes back to the times of the second generation of Amoraim. Am Rabbi Chiya bar Abba, Am Rabbi Yochanan. So we have a tradition from Rabbi Yochanan. Kol ha-Nevi'im kulan lo ninamu elimot ha-Mashiach. All of the great prophecies about the lamb and the lion and all these things are only about Yimot ha-Mashiach. Aval la'olam haba, meaning whatever world comes after that, ayin lo rata alim zolatacha. Only God has seen it, no man has seen it, which means the greatest and wildest and most fantastical prophecies that we have are about Mashiach. Whatever is going to happen afterwards, we don't have any info, right? Upli God is Shmuel. This is at odds with the position of Shmuel. Damar Shmuel ain bein olam hazeh l'imot Mashiach el hashivud malchiyot bilvad. That the only difference between this world and the days of Mashiach, this world means the reality that we have today, and the days of Mashiach is being subjugated to the nations. Meaning that today, I'm Shmuel, and I'm living a pretty good Jewish life, in a pretty fair Jewish life, in Bavel, but I'm under Shapur the king. So the only difference is that we'll be sovereign. That'll be called Yimot HaMashiach. Meaning, Yimot HaMashiach pretty much looks like our world. It's not the lion with the lamb, and it's not all of these other fantastical pictures, but rather it's a normal world, and the difference is political. That's Shmuel. All right? Good. So that's right away you can see that dispute that existed in within the world of religious Zionism is a dispute that goes back to the Gemara. And by the way, it's a dispute that's picked up by the Rishonim. The Rambam clearly rules like Shmuel. And the Rambam clearly says all those things of the lion and the lamb, those are all metaphors of being able to live securely in the land and not being afraid.
What does their authority mean about these, their opinions here? Are we assuming that they're bringing down a tradition? Are we assuming that they read some sort of text that we didn't really read the same way?
Correct. We have no idea. And throughout this entire sugya, we're going to be operating in the same dark. Because we're not going to have, so with a couple exceptions, we're not going to have recourse to tradition, as in saying, I heard from my Rebbe, you go back to the first Nevi'im, this tradition. Psukim, all the psukim about any of this stuff are very easy to read multiple ways and will be read multiple ways. And we could also play pasuk ping pong, which is, I got a pasuk, you got another pasuk. You're going to see it right below. You see the Aleph through Tet? That's pasuk ping pong right there. I'll show it to you.
What does it mean that the Gemara rules like one of them?
I said the Rambam.
The Rambam rules like
the Rambam. Okay, the Rambam said you should understand it, and that probably is driven a lot by the Rambam's own philosophical orientation, how he understands things and how he reads Pesukim. Right? He's not saying I think Shmuel's a smarter rabbi than Rabbi Yochanan. He's saying that position of Shmuel that Yemot HaMashiach is not supposed to be a fantastical world, but a normal world with a political, military changes to our benefit is how he reads the other Makorot. We'll put it on the website. Hamarav. Kalu kol akitzin. Now you're going to see another machloket, which is not related to that. Ve'ein adorat talui ela b'tshuva ma'asim tovim. Now kalu kol akitzin opens up a door to a very dangerous area, and that is all of the end times are gone. What that means is that, and part of the reason I don't want to put translations, all the translations are more misleading than anything else, because they all need discussion. Kates, we know we're familiar with the word, Kates Hayamin, is an end time, meaning there's a particular time given, Ve'im, wherever it may be, this is when the history is supposed to end. Rav says we passed all those dates now, which means there are opportunities missed, maybe. All it depends on is us, Shuva Masim Tov, which means if we can do en masse tshuva and masim tovim, then we'll be redeemed. And if not, things will remain the way they are forever. Right? Shmuel Amar Dayola Avel Shiamon Me'avlo. Now Shmuel, who just said that Yemot HaMashiach is a naturalistic, historic improvement, says it's enough that a mourner should, a mourner should only mourn for so long. Who's the mourner? The mourner's God. And God's in mourning when we're in exile, so the mourning, at some point, is going to be up. Which means, whether we do something or not, it's going to be up. Ketanoi, and this is a machlok ketanaim. Rebbe Eliezer Omer, Yisrael osin tshuva nigalin, v'lav ein nigalin. If I'm Yisrael, there's tshuva, they'll be redeemed. If not, they're not redeemed. It's up to us. Now, Rabbi Shua's answer is very interesting because it's not a direct opposition. Amar Rabbi Shua, im ein yosin tshuva, ein nigalin. You're right. Ela kadosh baruch hu mamidlan melech shegzerotav kashot kaman. You know what God will do? God still wants to redeem us. You know what he's going to do? He's going to give us a king that's worse than Haman. Or as bad as Haman. Yisrael is in tshuva. And then I'm Yisrael do tshuva. Masiran the mutav. In other words, you're right that Am Yisrael has to do tshuva to be redeemed. Right? However, God won't sit by on the sidelines twiddling his thumbs waiting for us to do tshuva. He's going to push tshuva. How does he push tshuva? He's going to put us in an impossibly terrible circumstance, and we'll do tshuva. Right? Which, of course, we've seen several times didn't work. But, all right? Tanya Idach. Now, this brayta with pasuk ping pong goes differently. Rabbi Eliezer Mary Yisrael is in tshuva nigalin shenemar, and he quotes a pasuk. Right? Amar Rabbi Yeshua. Rabbi Yeshua quotes another pasuk, which is, you've been sold for nothing, and you won't be redeemed by Kesef, and he interprets that, that's the ellipsis, as you won't be saved by Masim Tovim, you're going to be saved free, which means, I'm going to save you. Rabbi Yeshua says, I'll look for an Emar, Shuvar Elai V'Shuvar Elichem, return to me and I'll return to you. That's in Zechariah. That's in Malachi. Rabbi Yeshua, I'll look for an Emar, Ki Anochi Ba'alti V'Lachem, Lakakti Etchem, Echad Me'ir U'Shnai Mishpacha, V'Yitit Etchem Tzion. I'll pick you up and I'll bring you back. What does Rabbi Elazar say? And he quotes a pasuk. Rabbi Yeshua comes back with another pasuk. Rabbi Elazar comes with another pasuk. In other words, do you have psukim that will support the idea that Am Yisrael has to initiate the move? Yes. Do you have psukim that say God's going to do it out of his own beneficence? Yes. All right? The telling thing is at the bottom. Mishatak Rabbi Elazar. What does that mean?
He gave in.
Either he gave in or he gave up.
Isn't he the one that lost in the other discussion?
Yeah. But either he gave in or he gave up. What does that mean? He gave in, meaning you win. Or he gave up, he said, there's no reasoning with this guy.
Right.
It's not a question of counting psukim. I got 12, you got 11.
Well, when you say shatak, that or whatever.
We don't know what that means.
Is it used elsewhere?
Yes. And both ways are interpreted. Right. Sometimes shatak is frustration with the guy asking the question. And sometimes shatak is acquiescence.
Well, that's purposely done then that way.
So we don't know. The way that often this is read is to say that he gave in. And he said, okay, you're right. The psukim overwhelmingly say, God will save us whether we deserve it or not. But on the other hand, in the earlier statement, he seemed to stick to his guns. All right. So I wanted to show you, and in this time, we'll end with this, and if you'd like, we'll continue on, because the back page is even more fascinating. But I want to show you this passage from the Yerushalmi, which is the only passage not from Sanhedrin here. It's from the Yerushalmi Brachot. And the beginning of the Yerushalmi Brachot is even wilder and more fun than the beginning of Bavli Brachot, which is a lot of fun. And one of the things that happens, because the beginning of Brachot talks about sunset and sunrise, etc., we have this passage. Now, Dilma Rabbi Chia Rabba, this is Yerushalmi. Rabbi Chia Rabba means the great Rabbi Chia. Who's Rabbi Chia? Rabbi's student, Rab's uncle. Rabbi Shimon ben Chalafta, of Mahalchim Bada Bikat Arbel. They were walking in Bikat Arbel. You know where Bikat Arbel is? If you go out of Tveria west and a little bit north, you go into a mountainous valley. It's called Bikat Arbel. And there's an ancient tradition that Mashiach is supposed to make his first appearance there, which is why many Chachamim wanted to be buried there. And that's where you find a lot of the Kivrot HaTanaim, maybe. I mean, that's right. So now, Bikritzta, it was dawn. They saw the dawn starting to little creak. Amar v'chir Rabbi Rabbi Shimon Chalafta, the Rebbe, he said to him, "Kachi gulatan shel Yisrael." You see that little light? That's how we're going to be redeemed. V'tchila kima kima, right? A little bit of time. Komashi olechet yirabav olechet, and a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more, right? My tama, why keishev b'choshech Adonai orli. They quote the pasuk from Micha, when I sit in the darkness, God is my light, and God brings the light. Right? And then he goes to Psukim from, of all places, Megillat Esther. We have Mordechai, and this, by the way, is not the light gets a little bitter, but rather two steps forward, one step back. Mordechai is sitting in the gates, and then he stepped back, he's wearing sackcloth and ashes. Then he's wearing royal clothes and sackcloth and ashes, etc., etc. Until finally, Vayedim Haytah Rav Simcha. But critical is, they read Megillat Esther as being the blueprint for Gula, for a particular kind of Gula. Now, when are they living? They are living 150 years after the Churban. They are living under Rome. This is pre-Christian, living under Rome. Under Rome post-Hadrian, so things are really difficult. And they're looking at it and he's saying, you know, that's how we're going to be redeemed. A little bit at a time, a little bit of light, darkness a little lighter, darkness a little bit. And there are people, by the way, who have written their manifestos on religious Zionism based on this piece. I even have a book at home that's called Kima Kima, slowly, slowly, based on this piece. And so this is another rabbinic approach, but this is not in conflict with the ones we've seen. The first one we saw was the machloket about whether or not the world of Mashiach is going to be a fantastical world or a normal world. The second machloket is, what's going to bring it? Do we have to do something or is it going to happen by itself, no matter what? And the third issue is, what's the process going to look like? Right? And you'll notice, nobody else, this is what Yossi asked before, nobody knows. We have a pasuk that supports this, we have a pasuk that supports that. And so are they operating based on a tradition? Are they operating based on their interpretation of other sources? Are they operating based on looking at the world and watching how things work and understanding this, how God's work? We don't know. They don't tell us. But we'll look at next week, we're going to look at the Makarot on the back, which speak much more directly to some of the issues of when, a little bit of how, and some really beautiful stories related to that. And we hopefully will have a Chag Sameach on Tuesday. I guess Yisru Chag together.